Hello and welcome back to Blacker Couch Reviews. I'm your host, Christina. We're back to discuss a new series that has been on everyone's radar since its premiere, February of 2024, on Hulu and FX, Shogun. It's an American historical drama television miniseries created by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, based on the novel of the same name by James Clavell. Our starring cast is one of my favorite actors. At least I seem to love him in everything that I come across seeing him in, which is Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays the titular character of Lord Yoshi Toranaga. Mr. Intense Blue Eyes, the actor I've never seen in anything until this moment, Cosmo Jarvis, plays Pilot Major John Blackthorne. Anna Sawai as Tota Mariko. Tada Naobu Asana, or Asano, as Yabu Shigu, or Shige. I may be saying these names incorrectly, so please have some mercy. Takahiro Hira as Ishido. Tommy Basto as Father Martin Alvito. And Fumi Nikero as Ochiiba or Ochiba Nokato. Supporting cast, the only one I'm going to reference is the two that were introduced in this episode for the most part. Nestor Carbonell as Vasco Rodriguez and Tokuma Nishioka as Tota Iron Fist Hiromatsu. This miniseries is 10 episodes long. It is set in Japan. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of commentary regarding the authenticity in some of the culture. So I'm going to be curious to see how representative of the 17th century Japan that we are seeing. But right now, I could tell you I love the cinematography. I think it's being used very effectively, particularly the blurring of the screens a little bit. I won't say I'm an expert in any Japanese history. I do know some things, but I am not nearly as integrated into all of the key points of the culture as this show probably is going to delve into and get me interested into. And that's also another reason why I was excited to jump in, because it's going to inspire me wanting to learn more. I can tell you that the seppuku that they showed was very accurate with the white robes and everything, because that's part of the tradition. You may not know about it. Like, so most people think it's just, hey, I'm gonna kill myself. But there's actually layers and certain things that are done. It's a very sad part of the culture and tradition. And it certainly was introduced in a very gut-wrenching manner to introduce the audience to the stakes of this land, this world that John himself is coming into, with this idea of savagery, which is something that's played off of through both perspectives, thought hilariously. And before I start rambling on and on and on with absolutely no structure, I'm going to go reference my notes, which I wanted to have for this first episode because I knew that I would need to actually write some notes for the episode, because there's a lot going on. And then there's, I don't know if there is an English dub version, because I would never click on it. So I have to catch a lot of the names and places. So that is definitely, this show is probably definitely going to continue to be a, for the most part, scene by scene breakdown, just so that I am consistent, at least until I get comfortable. With that said, let's jump into it. A ship emerges from the darkness, bringing with it seemingly the plague from all the dead that's scattered about. I didn't think anyone was going to be left alive, but it was just on this one vessel. There was another one that had more lively specimens aboard. The year is 1600. For decades, the Portuguese Catholics have richly profited from the trade in Japan, having kept it secret from their enemies, the dreaded European Protestants, because America didn't exist yet, so we couldn't blame the American Protestants, who certainly learned a lot from their European counterparts. And this is also, I believe, the time of the, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? It starts with an I. Why is it not coming to my brain right now? the when they were going around Inquisition, thank you, Jesus, going around persecuting Catholics or persecuting Protestants very heavily, particularly in Catholic countries. You know, they didn't have to worry about that so much in some other countries because they turned Protestants or they were more tolerant. But if you were in any type of Spanish colony, which was the superpower before Britain took over, and the Portuguese, actually, it's not just the Spanish, but the Portuguese, then yes, you would have met with a very intolerant practice to your faith whenever they decided to blame them for anything. Them and the Jews. The Jews always get it from every side, though. White sands indicate that the pilot, John, is right. They are going to reach shore soon, and the shores of Japan, or the Japans as they call it. That's because the island of Japan and the island of Hong Kong were considered the two Japans. But the captain, suffering scurvy, is drawing the line as 500 men and 5 ships have been reduced to this creaking vessel and its friend. They've run out of food. Today they've run out of water. And he's lost all hope. He tells him the Almighty is calling them home before shooting himself in the head.
If you're feeling suicidal, you've come to the right place.
Now, if you're cynical like me, who was raised Protestant, by the way, you would have thought, wow, how could God be calling you home when suicide is considered self-murder and thus a sin, so God would not be welcoming you anywhere? It would be the devil whose clutches, according to your faith, you would be landing into. A lone man sees a large ship coming out of the mist, and unlike Lindisfarne, the army is promptly sent.
The fuck you doing here, nigga? Identify yourself. Who the fuck are you?
Different scenario, but you get my dark humor. I like the way they utilize this unknown person as the spy. And that we saw him from the beginning and then we see him in the end and you just didn't even put that together. But of course, he saw and he told his lord exactly what he knew his underlings would not. The pilot is found in the hold while the other samurai wonder who the heck are these people. And why only the pilot has clean teeth? Were you the only one thinking that lemons or oranges? Actually, I think it's oranges because it's vitamin C, right? Vitamin C is what causes, or lack of vitamin C is what causes scurvy. And the British Navy didn't know that. at the time, despite it being common knowledge on some ships. A hawk is used as a metaphor to introduce our titular character, Lord Taranaga, who shields oneself against the sun, conserving energy until the right moment to attack the silent opponent. They're on their way with his son to Osaka Castle at the behest of Lord Ishido, that demand asks that he stay in his personal quarters as the Lord watches. Well, it's the servants that convey the message, but the Lord watches the message get received. Another remarks, I'm surprised he came, and he says, a wise man knows when his time has ended. Does that mean you, sir, are not a wise man, as you can't see that you're messing with fire that shall lead to your own demise? The Council of Regents have summoned Lord Taranaga to the shithole as Hiro Matsu. I will be calling him Iron Fist going forward because A, it's a badass nickname. Already pointed that out. And B, it's a perfect nickname to shorten trying to say his last name repeatedly throughout this podcast. If I can find a way to shorten someone's name and give them a nickname, you're damn sure I'm going to do it. But at least I will tell you who they are so that you can follow along. So the Council of Regents have summoned him here because he's seemingly aligning himself with enemies against the council. A year after the Taiko's death, which I'm guessing that's like a shogun without the title of shogun, who would have forbid him making these alliances, but here he is, having arranged 6 marriages, and just this morning they were made aware he took the heir's mother to his castle at Edo, something Ishido thinks is his way to ensure his own safety here. Whereas Lord Taranaga claims it's for his daughter's labor. My daughter-in-law, she's about to go into labor. She could use some maternal influence. That it happened to be the same day that I'm being summoned here, that's just a coincidence. Taranaga further thinks the Taiko, I'm not sure how to say that correctly, would be pleased that they can still all disagree, but remains he is content being Lord of Kanto, despite his fiefdom doubling, and that we all agreed to share power equally between us until the heir comes of age, and I do look forward to that day. He's charismatic, he's direct, he doesn't act like he's bothered or he has anything to hide, so somehow Ishido, from what I'm picking up, has gotten the council to turn against him, but he himself knows that he has to play the game humbly before he can have the necessary tools to fight back against this deadline that he's been given. Toddy, that's who I'm going to call him, the entire time been shaken with outrage that his lord would have to hear such insults when he is presented with a demand to return the lady in 7 days upon impeachment, causing him to break the golden rule of having anyone's daimyo, maybe? I can't remember what the foot soldiers are called. Enter the sacred chamber, but Taranaga, upon sign.
Oh, Lord. Again. A fucking again. Nothing new, nothing changed. Same old shit. Same old fucking.
Tells him very frankly he's received no insults, causing his subject or soldier to apologize and offer or ask permission to commit seppuku, ending his entire bloodline. Oh shit, I'm fucked up. Taranaga offers his apologies, but Ishido takes this opportunity to insult his clan, akinning the actions as a childish outburst, although clearly the offer of seppuku was granted. And he leaves the room. This is also a new setup that they have. Something he points out when he comes into the room. Iron Fist joins him again as he's receiving a message. That's how they communicate. I love the use of birds. I know you see that in Harry Potter and you think, oh, this is only something Europeans did. Nope, this is how we communicated all over the globe, by training different pigeons and different birds to transport messages. It's kind of crazy that that was our method. Terranaga knows, despite the impending disaster that is plotted against him and his distaste for the useless bloodshed, that the boy was brave, not stupid, for speaking up, and ensures Iron Fist that his daughter, Lady Fuji, is going to be spared from that fate. He wants Iron Fist to go to the barbarian ship and wonders if his friend is considering his options, knowing that once they have secured the lady, the council do intend to vote them to be killed.
He's too dangerous to be left alive.
On the ship, the pilot, John Blackthorne, tells his men that they aren't going to die, because that seems to be his pushing goal right now. I'm not meant to die. Well, a lot of people feel that way. Does not stop them from meeting their fate. But he convinces his crew, look, we're going to simply pass ourselves off as merchants with goods to trade, because all indications are that they have reached the Japans. As I told you, we would reach them. We got through Spanish ships on either side of us. And one of the guys points out, this is the man that got us through. So follow me. We're going to be fine. And any indication of what we actually are, which is pirates, or what do they call them under the Elizabethan era? Lord, why is my brain not working right now? And it's right at the tip of my tongue every time. Privateers. Tota attempts to take his son from his wife, who is upset that she has been ordered to live while her son has to die along with his father due to him stepping out of line. But Mariko, who has felt the pull of death before, knows that he is right, although he has no right to be harsh after his own stupidity condemned her son to die. Mariko is told she is living a life without purpose by not following her own father, is my guess, into committing seppuku. But being spared is her purpose, as she eases the knife away from her own throat, because she was going to cut her throat if they came any closer to her taking the child. But I'm like, if I'm a mom, you might as well put me in the grave. I'm not rejecting that mercy at all. I will not accept my baby just being taken from me and I have to live on without them. In such a manner, too. Mariko demands the mother's hands be the last to hold the child. Once alone, Mariko breaks down, revealing that her faith is Catholic, which is another point of contention when it comes to seppuku, because it's suicide and Catholics would be banned from heaven if they were to commit suicide. So I think it's, yeah, I think the line at the end about having three hearts is intriguing. Lord Yabushigi, who will now be called Yabu, uncle to a boy whose name I never caught, whose desires is to have his own fief one day, is told by his mother that this is his only opportunity to gain what he seeks as this man didn't come to pay respects when your father died a year ago, so you better impress. I enjoyed the cultural confusion as they were trying to get everyone up the ladder. He's like, no, one person speaks for my men. I'm choosing to go up the ladder. But they send men down to get them up the ladder. They're both calling each other savages because anyone who's not culturally appropriated to the other is a savage. That's just, I mean, a word thrown out there as uncivilized when in fact it simply means different than what you yourself considered civilized behavior. A Christian man is asked to translate amongst the villagers managing to get out, be good, and that his request is impossible to go home, although he has it confirmed he is indeed in the Japans. Also liked how they got him up. They kept one of the guys down there, but they dumped like this fish blood and guts down there to get the foursome to come up. That was pretty funny. And while Yabu can't understand the insult at his hospitality, Homeboy definitely knows he was insulted with the universal gesturing because he grabbed his cock and said he was going to piss on his land. So he decided to piss on John's head.
You shouldn't have been talking shit.
Then repeats the word he learned to understand that very quickly. I thought that was kind of gangster. I started off being like, I don't trust this guy. I don't like him. But by the end, I think I like him. But I'm not sure I'm supposed to. I don't know what side he's on. I think he's going to be a shifty motherfucker. And that's okay. Because when you're playing dangerous games, that's how people are. Like, everyone loves to believe that you're loyal and you're on one side. It's like, no. When you decide to jump into the power game, you better shift with the tides. And the only way you don't get drowned is making sure you move before that tide comes to crash you or a wave comes to crash you. A villager got nosy as they were trekking John back through town. And instead of backing off as he was told, he makes the sign of the cross, causing him to have his head chopped off.
You know the rules, and so do I. Say goodbye.
I like the brutality of this scene, and it definitely highlights something they indicated earlier, the dark times that came before, that there's a lot of people with very little power under a very small minority of people who have a lot of power. And at any moment in time, like, there's no outrage, there's no response, there's a clear fear from these villages that are visited once in a while. And at any time, violence can erupt and it's prolific. And in Japan, be good or face the very harsh consequences. A priest is brought to interpret, but it's clear that A, he has very limited understanding of the Japanese language, and B, has no idea that the world is much larger than they suspect. The Japanese don't know that, and he, John, fully puts that together, and that the Catholic Portuguese have been touting themselves as the only power in Europe without them understanding that the Dutch and the Protestants and the Catholics are not friends. They're enemies. They're mortal enemies. And they're fighting over resources and power and also control over all other peoples in the entire continent. He is able to convey a dissociation with the priest, which earns him a bath and a stay, earning his interest from Yabu. Because in his mind, he's pandering or he's being tolerant of the priest and the Christians, but it's clear he doesn't have any real love for them. And he wants to know and wants to learn something that he know he's not getting all the information of. I mean, if you're sitting there in the middle of a conversation, you go, oh, he's bad man. He's pirate. You need to kill him. He's a danger. And you see that these two people are speaking to each other in a way that says there's history there and they're strangers. Yeah, if I was sitting there, I'm like, nah, 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 nah. I don't know what the fuck he's saying, but I know I'm not getting the whole story, but I need to figure out what his story is and why he's against these other people that I don't even know if we like here. The irony of all of this is not lost on me as someone who loves history, but yeah. He is told, though, just to placate him, he can choose another to kill in his place. In his special way, in Yabu's special way. But he won't be murdering John to John's pleasure, who tells the priest that eventually us Protestants are going to be all over these shores. And in this conversation between these two, it's like they're competing over the resources from this place, right? There's no respect for the people here, the land. They see this as a place to get shit, and they want the shit, and they want to dominate getting the shit to the rest of the world. And the Catholics, having that power, gives them the money in the church, and that means that their religion gets to be prolific. My God needs to win, so I need to take over these resources and then spread my religion throughout the entire world because we have the most power and the most money. While playing with his niece, we learn Lord Taranaka. I could just call him Taranaka, was a hostage passed around between his enemies as a child until he became a teenager. I think I got her name right. Deninio knows that Ishido is behind this masquerade, having promised the regents his fiefdom. Taranaga assumes for falling in line, but she knows he has ultimate goals of his own. She fears for the heir, but Taranaga promises to protect the heir with his life. However, he does not have the necessary tools to go against the rest of the council or Ishida due to them having a alliance. We learn with the Catholics, who have things that they need, which is superior quality cannons, musket balls, and gunpowder. Even though gunpowder was made China. I want to say it was made in Japan, but they used it only for fireworks because they didn't think this thing was a weapon. But you best believe other people saw the use. And that's not to say that clearly Japan didn't have and is a very bloodthirsty, has its own, I'm sure as we get further into the series, its own issues. But it is their continent, it is their way of life, so to speak. And this power game is just that. And they're utilizing in their mind these minority Catholics. She points out they fear his ancestral Minowara bloodline. But she tells him this isn't the time for good men, but for a shogun. He demurs because he has no wish to see or basically to assume such a relic title. But she implores him to reconsider as he is the splint holding up the plant that is growing. And I guess the heir was the little boy he was playing the game with. Back in the village, they listen as one sailor is selected for a very brutal death in a cauldron of boiling water.
Oh, hell no!
His screams piercing the night as John receives his bath, saying, someone was screaming all last night. You want to tell me who that was? Was that a villager? Or is that one of my men? Or you knew that was one of your men. One of his servants, Yabu's servants, tell Kiku, a courtesan, that his lord is obsessed with the moments before death, how men face such moments, with this being the closest he can get to it. He remarks that the man's last moments were inarticulate once he joins them and is introduced to Kiku, who quickly takes control of the situation with the servant, understanding instinctively that homeboy likes to watch more than engage. Or he possibly could be homosexual, and watching her perform on him was more erotic. I'm sure we'll get more information in the future. I like the complexity of Yabu. It's exactly the kind of complexity I would see in a culture or a society where your rise to the top is going to always come with a stack of bodies. When masculinity and honor are very prevalent, when you can't back down from a challenge, even if it's to your death. Just a lot of things in place that would psychologically transform the normalcy of someone's existence. And I think watching him be someone that at first kind of comes off as this douchebag. And I mean, and then you find out he's a little ambitious, and then you get to where we get to him at the end. There's just a lot of layers there, I think, and it'd be very easy to make a character like him one note. And I'm glad that they decided to give him a very real feeling. Because the next morning, John finds himself hungry, naked, and in need of boots. Whereas the Lord is still talking about the barbarian and how long it took him to die. He does remark, these Christians are stronger. He asks his nephew to cite a poem regarding the man who died, because poetry and art is something that Japanese culture appreciates a lot. And having to come up with some bars on the spot, that can be intimidating. He said his eyes were just the end of hell, all pain, articulate.
Proud of your boy.
The uncle is impressed. Yabu congratulates him on how he's running the village. He tells him that our lord, Taranaga, which is our first indication that he is under him, believes will be dead soon, leaving room for war. The nephew is quickly able to point out that his uncle intends to use this boon, the weapons on that ship, to aid in that war effort, because Lord Ishido will become the most powerful regent and he'll have to contend with the Christians and their weapons, and having weapons, their weapons of our own to use against them would definitely be to my advantage. So I love the 3D chest. It's like, yeah, we're aligning with the Christians, but we actually don't want them to be here. Whereas the Christians are trying to align with them and keep the Protestants out. Hiromatsu arrives.
Stolen.
He came for all his shit. He know how much artillery, how much gold, how much silver is on that ship, and confiscates it from his lower minion, who was told, by the way, to stay in Edo, but clearly made his move. When he balks at his loyalty being brought into question, or he did balk and then his loyalty was brought into question, just like that, his plans evaporated into smoke with his nephew right there to see how he got embarrassed. And he tells him, this village has a spy. And I thought he was going to take it out on his nephew, and he didn't. John asks about his men and gets belligerent, also thinking that his wardrobe was a little too tight, when he is told he's being taken to Osaka. Another English speaker intervenes. This is Rodriguez. And after confirming he is a pilot, tells him one man was executed and the rest may be freed if they behave, but it is out of his hands. It's out of everyone's hands at this point. And you're being taken to someone who is so powerful. If he wants to play with your balls, you should let him. He tells them that they aren't friends since he's a Catholic and he's a Protestant. And any chance of escape ain't happening, so go ahead and kiss that ship goodbye. Yabu really doesn't want to go back to becoming a prisoner. It was one of the very few funny moments in the episode where he's like, we really got to go back? That's some bullshit. John continues to express that he is not a pirate, despite Rodriguez knowing full well this young, ambitious, plotting motherfucker is exactly that, and that his lack of respect for the savages tickles him in lieu of exactly what the Dutch have been doing, him in particular. They know a storm is coming. When the storm does arrive, the pilot is left in charge of rowing the ship. And while John wants him to turn into the well, he's like, where's your cojones? Nah, if I can't swim, I'm going to trust the person who might be able to steer this boat better than me. It's not pretty, but John is able to encourage everyone to row, quickly learning key words in their language, impressing Yabu, who also went down to help steer the ship, which also impressed me. Because you have those people that are in power that are like, I'm never going to, like, you're never going to see noblemen in England. I think there was a movie that actually showed something like, to their detriment, they'll just sit there. Like, I don't do manual labor. What the fuck are you talking about? But he went down there and he had no problem joining his men to get them to row the ship and get the authority needed down there, while he goes back upstairs to find that Rodriguez has been tossed overboard. So John throws him a paddle and intends to rescue him. And despite them not being friends, they do have their own code of honor, which is, I don't leave people behind. Iron Fist doesn't agree, but Yabu takes up the challenge, and John learns firsthand what it means to live by your honor when he realizes, despite the risks, Yabu cannot be shown to be weak and goes down to rescue the pilot because it was his idea to rescue the pilot. However, in the process, faces certain death, because John would have went down himself, but he had to be the one to do it, even though this another servant also offered to do it. But just as all hope is lost and he rescues Rodriguez, John witnesses him about to commit seppuku so that he dies with honor. But then another rope is brought because he would rather have chosen his own death, he's explained to later on, which is the best thing that could exist than letting fate decide for you. Or letting, even though they talk a lot about fate in this episode as well. Being humbled, though, he does bow to Yabu, which causes the man to chuckle.
These nuts. Got him. Got him.
I think there's a burgeoning respect just based on principles alone. And that speaks a lot about who you are, particularly in this land. In Osaka, Tarunaga summons Mariko and thanks her for helping Lady Fuji with her grief. She's been married into the family for 16 years now to a general, but she and Tarunaga are not close. She is aware of the vote that could be laid against him and their house and says that they will die happily. She is asked to translate, because he's going to bring a pirate here. I like that he clearly knows that he's a pirate. And that he's also from a different religion than her religion. He brings up her father and how he knows that death haunted her, as she was not permitted to join him in death. But he wants to restore her purpose in the fight, and she confirms her faith won't intervene because she's asked to translate. I think I already stated that. With wanting to help with that, because he wants to elevate her to a place of power. Back on the ship, Rodriguez admits to John that he knows how savage he actually is, because he's like, fuck it, you saved my life, so at least you should give me known the heads up. Because he says, I fought too hard. He's like, oh, I thought you just landed here by accident. Yeah, like I thought. His mission is to destroy Catholic ports and make their way to Japan to open trade. He's no saint. And Rodriguez tells him, I'm going to give this information to my people when we arrive in port. And who knows, maybe you'll live, maybe you'll die. But you need to seriously stop calling these people savages. Because I need you to go up there and take a peek, because we're approaching Osaka soon. And see how far they have come to where we are at. And wonder what kind of person, man, wields power here. A man who schemes up front, or someone who is in the shadows. And every man has three hearts, one in his mouth for the world to know, another in his chest just for his friends, and a secret heart buried deep where no one can find it. And that is the heart a man must keep hidden if he wants to survive in Japan. That's where we also get the reveal that the translator was the spy. And that is how we end the episode, because we're talking about fate, and you have Terunaga saying that I think that we're fated. And you had Rodriguez bringing up the word for it, shimuku or shimike. I know I ain't saying that right. But it's this idea that our fates are all intertwined. And at this very crucible moment, there's going to be a change, and these are going to be the players that are involved in having a part in that change. I'm really curious on how this goes forward. I thought this was a really strong pilot episode. I gave it a 9.7 out of 10. I'm really loving getting into understanding the world in this time and not in England. or in France, right? We always focus on those two continents as if they're the only ones to ever exist and will exist. We are woefully taught about the rest of history and all of the influence, or more like colonization, that a lot of these European countries did to more sophisticated continents and superpowers. And I think that Japan deciding to cut itself away from the strife of the European world was a decision, I think, that was supposed to be culturally healthy. And unfortunately, that gave them the advantage that I think, had Japan continued its course in history, could have definitely turned things. Because, yeah, they definitely were, and they're really gaining their power in the 21st century. One of the great superpowers of the time, along with China, and for their a lot stability wise, as far as like because what am I talking about stability wise? They had a lot of crashing and a lot of falling, but not from outside influences. That's what I was trying to communicate. Yeah, so the gummy's kicking in. So I think this is the perfect time to say if you want to send feedback for our next episode, blackercouch@gmail.com, or can leave a comment below. My social media will be there as well. Remember to like, share, and subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast, wherever good podcasts can be found. We do have mail, so let's hop into the mailbag.
Mail, motherfucker!
What up, Stina? It's Mimi. This is my feedback for Shogun. I believe is how you say it. I could be pronouncing it wrong. This is season 1, episode 1. I don't really know how I am going to, I guess, approach this, because there was so much going on and I don't really know the characters' names yet, or like I can't remember plots with faces yet, except the Christian Asian Japanese girl, which I thought was very, very peculiar. I wasn't expecting to see Christians in Japan. And the main character, the guy that was in Westworld. So I can say one thing I do love about it, one of my biggest pet peeves. And because I went to Paris, I can say nowadays, realistically, what Daryl Dixon is going through, where people are can speak English, is realistic, because when we were there in Paris, mostly, most people spoke English. Like, they would start with French, and then when you tell them you don't speak French, they'll switch to English. So that's realistic. But one of my biggest pet peeves is when I see a show or a movie that has the story in a different country other than America, but everybody's speaking English. Shit pisses me off. It's like, why is this not in another language with subtitles? But they did not do that, and I approved. I was like, okay, so far I can watch this. Whenever we're watching something, especially like if I'm watching like a show where, like, you know, they go to like time travel, like I was watching Quantum Leap. Season 2, in one of the episodes, they went to like 18, shit, it might not even be 18, it was the Salem Witch Trials, and the main character was speaking like slang language and speaking English regular, and everybody was understanding him. I was like, this is such bullshit. Who wrote this? This is terrible. There's no way that you would be able to understand what he's saying. So I will say that because they did not do that, I appreciate it. I don't know enough about Japanese history to know what is actually going on, but I was surprised to see there was a white man that had a lot of lines, which I'm assuming we're gonna be stuck with him. I was like, okay, I guess there can be white people here. Don't want to say I'm disappointed, but I think I might be. Wasn't expecting him to be there. Also wasn't expecting him to be a main character, and he got a lot of lines, so I'm assuming he is. I don't know who he is, but I'm assuming he is a pirate. When he was first introduced, I'm assuming he was the guy at the beginning that was on the ship with that old man. And I'm pretty sure that old man was in some episode of Black Sails. He looks very familiar. And he looks like a pirate. I'm like, okay, they must be pirates. And then when they were down in the bottom of the ship, which I thought they all was going to be dead. But anyway, he was like, let's just say we're merchants. I was like, okay, so he must be a pirate. So I'm assuming that's what he is. And then there was a bunch of, like, you know, I guess there was a Spaniard guy, and then there was that Catholic guy who was in Japan, that spoke Japanese, and then Portuguese, I know, is one of the languages he speaks, but I don't feel like he's from Portugal. Like, he seemed like he's British, or I'm not sure if because I heard him say, I speak a little Portuguese, which means that he's not from Portugal. He must speak English, but some people speak Portuguese. I'm not quite sure what the language barrier is. I know the Japanese people, and then the pirate is speaking another language. I'm assuming it's English, but I only heard him speak English, so I haven't heard him speak any Portugal. So they did, I did knock a couple numbers down. If you're gonna throw that line in there, y'all should have had him speaking Portugal. One of the issues I will say I will have, I'm not gonna be able to watch this quickly, so if I don't have time, I'm not gonna be able to send feedback in timely, because I don't read fast enough for subtitles, which is one of the reasons I don't watch foreign movies. I know that's not an excuse. It's one of the things I stress about a lot with Derek. I stress with him how important it is that you should have the fundamental of reading. It was not something that was brought to me. So I didn't read a lot as a child, other than stuff that I had to. I didn't know reading could be fun until I was older. I was actually in high school, like a senior. So my comprehension skills have always been there. I've always been able to read things and understand them. And it's crazy now that I know that they were supposed to give me more time so I can read the thing. But when you have parents that don't pay attention, that's shit you won't know. But I didn't have enough. I never had enough time. Like, there would be like three passages, and I only had enough time to get through like two of them completely. And then the third one, I wouldn't have enough time to finish reading the whole thing. So I think I don't read fast because it was a skill that I did not develop as a child. Derek reads really, really fast. He's literally been in gifted classes his whole life, and he those Dog Man books he loves. I would give him one. I would buy it at the grocery store. We would see it, and then before dinner's even over, before I finish cooking dinner, that fool has already finished reading it. So he reads pretty fast. I do not. So subtitles are hard for me to get through sometimes. And sometimes I have to rewind it because they'll switch to the next line too quickly before I can actually read it. I know I gotta keep doing it to get better at it, but it's just irritating when I wanna watch a show or a movie and I can't get through it. And then I don't wanna watch it with people because I don't wanna have to keep rewinding. So you're gonna have to be patient with me if this is a show I continue, because I don't read fast. Now that I then told you my entire life story, we can go on to the story itself. If I'm understanding everything correctly so far, our main character is a part of a split power, because the emperor, they're emperors, right? The main emperor died, and his son is too young to rule. So they divided the kingdom. That it wouldn't be a kingdom if it's not a king. They divided the territory amongst, I'm assuming, all his allies to have shared power, but they're planning a coup. I don't know why they picked that one guy out of all four of them to be the ruler, but it sounded like they were just making up some bullshit just so he can be impeached, because the mother-in-law of somebody was at his house, and they were like, oh, you're trying to divide power, or you're trying to steal power. That's why you had so many marriages planned to make your territory most powerful. And the guy was like, yeah, that's not what this is. My daughter-in-law went into labor, and that's why she's there, which makes sense, but okay. Then the one guy stood up talking about, don't talk about him like that. And then he was like, I'm assuming he was just trying to not start a complete war in that daggone area. He was like, no, that's not what's going on. And then the dude, like, I don't understand why he would say, as punishment, I'll kill myself and my whole bloodline. Like, there wasn't anything in between you not being punished and then you killing yourself and your son. Like, you couldn't say, I will give myself 12 lashings, I will starve myself for a week, like, I will only drink water for the next 14 days. I don't know. I feel like you went from 0 to 800,000, and I don't agree with that. And then you had the audacity to be mad at your wife for sentencing her son to death. she didn't want to get, it's like, I'm not giving him up. It's like, I am your husband. You listen to me. Fuck you. You're the reason we're in this mess. And I don't know exactly where that girl came from. It seems like the one who calmed the lady with the baby down is the main character's daughter-in-law. Have we seen his son? Did his son die? I'm not quite sure. I feel like we saw him talking to someone earlier, but I'm not quite sure if that was his son. And then she was the one that was a Christian, which really surprised me, because when she was in that room and she took that necklace off, I was like, is that a cross? I was so surprised. I was like, I don't know the religion that was popular back then in Japan, but Christianity was not something I thought, but clearly Christians made their way through the world. But that's a rant for another day. And then we had that one guy who boiled the one pirate to death. Like, that was an awful way to die. Like, I can't even fathom how awful that would be. And then he was like, he took too long to die. You boiled the man. You couldn't shoot him or boil him alive. Like, I don't know. It's something so sinister about that. And I really wanted him to die in those waves because it's what he would have deserved. But then they were like, you know, him choosing his own death. Like, he doesn't deserve that. He just deserves to be dead. Like, he is awful. I did like that one. I'm assuming she was like a prostitute, whatever fancy name they have it, and she was she was looking at him, and then she was like, she like started messing with the other guy while he watched. I was like, see, she know her craft. She can look at a man and tell what his fetish is, and I don't know why, but it made me like her. So I hope we see her again. The way she was like, do you want me to stop? And then he turned around and started eating his food, watching. Like, that was so funny. I know it wasn't supposed to be funny, but it made me laugh because I was like, she needs to get an extra, she need a tip for that, because she clearly knew what she was doing. She said she was the best. When he said she was the best at what she does, he was not wrong. That's the talent right there, to know what kind of kinks men want. You would be paid, is all I'm saying. And I'm not sure, the trajectory of this show, or what, the storyline is going to be. I'm unfamiliar with what a shogun is. I know they kind of went into it, the one guy is fighting his destiny, which never works. He doesn't like the violence. I'm sure something bad happened that we'll find out, but it seems like he's gonna have to suck it up and start fighting, because he's already he's supposed to be basically a dead man walking for whatever reason, because his daughter-in-law went into labor and the guys were just finding some excuse to act like he was pulling for power, and it's clear that he absolutely doesn't even want any. I know this was all over the place, but like I said, I don't really know the characters. I can't remember names right now. You know, it takes me at least 2-3 episodes. And then, it was so much going on. I don't really, I can't recall the plot because I don't remember people's names. It would just sound like a hot ass mess. But hopefully by episode 2, I'll be more organized. But I do like the format where I just go through the characters. It helps me remember better. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Try to remember people's names and faces so that I can give you more organized feedback. But until next time, love, peace, hair grease, and black girl magic. Queen of the Couch, Mimi out.
Thank you, Queen Mimi, for your thoughts on the episode. Girl, I ain't watching you watch the episode. I'm going to be patient with you. I'm reading this up. I ain't going to be there. So, yeah, I'll be as patient as you need me to be. I know what you mean, though, with the subtitles. They do go quick. Yeah, no, that's why I had to take notes. I said, a couple of episodes in, when I'm more familiar with the world, I'll probably be a little bit better at just going for the recap and then just getting into the meat and potatoes of everything. But for right now, I'm like, shit, I need to catch all this. There's a lot of places, there's a lot of names, there's a lot going on. And a lot of it has point placements for a necessary bit of commentary. Now, you know my ass is a freaking history whore, so I know a little bit about this. I know there was the Five Kingdoms, and I know that this guy, who's based on a real person, every character you've met thus far, the Christian, or Mariko, and John, they're all real people that they actually did. And yes, this is based on the story of a man who finally reunites the five warring factions under one shogunate. And then shit happens after that, like kicking out all the Christians. Wait, is this before? I feel like this is after the part where, yeah, this is, they shut themselves off. And then this is when some years later, when Europe was feeling themselves, they came knocking on. Yeah, because that was the 18th century. So this is 16th century. Yeah. So yeah, after this, they kick all the Christians out. So I can't remember if he's the one that does it, but I'm pretty sure his successors kick all the Christians out except for one little small port, which I think is what they gave them right now. So when it comes to Christians, merchants and pilgrims, that's what a lot of the merchants were, would go to different places in the world and they would introduce their religions. Now, in some of these places, they were persecuted and executed. In other places, they were tolerated because usually they were able to generate a little bit of money and exchange goods, and it's a way to access the outside world. There was no forcing the way the Catholic Church and, like, colonization is really what Europe is the encompassing of that, right? It's not that the faiths were all different. It's forcing your faith upon another group of people and your practices and your culture and your ideas and so on and so forth. That's colonization in my mind. So they're for Japan, it's almost like if this small little group came over and you're like, okay, well, you know, they don't know the outside world. They don't know how big the world is. Everything and everyone is always, for generations upon, since inception, revolved around this particular continent. So, yeah, from their perspective, these are, the Christians at this point to them are irrelevant, tolerated benefits, because they offer things that benefit them and their greater goals. And because they're not really a threat and don't pose a threat, because the Catholics did not try to colonize Japan, unlike the Protestants, they were able to continue this small peaceable trade between the continents. And then the idea, if people, which a lot of villagers would be interested in converting to Christianity, they were more than welcome to do so. You have to understand also, in a lot of places of power in the world, particularly their courts, they had a tendency, I think one, in India, and with a lot of the Arab countries, they weren't unlike, well, even the Christians, because they, I mean, there's hypocritical things that they teach in history, even about the Christians, that they were just very closed mind and they didn't know. No, people in fucking power knew. Why? Because knowledge was power. So yeah, if you don't know about the Chinese, what's the first thing you do? If Chinese people come onto your shores, you invite them to your court and you talk to them and you figure out what they know, because knowledge is power. And then if you can benefit from this other place that might have things, like, trade was how the world worked. So all of the religions, that's how they got passed around from place to place. Buddhism, Protestantism, Christianity, Hinduism, which is the oldest religion. So thinking about what the Japanese practice in that time, I want to say it was Hinduism, but don't quote me on that. But they, when you think of some of the older religions like Hinduism and even, not Islam. Oh, the one with all the gods and the thing where you go to Mecca. Oh, duh, I can't, my brain's not functioning right now, but that religion, and even the Buddhist gods, and even before in the Roman times, most religions were, had multiple gods. So there was no threat in the idea of different gods being around because a pantheon of gods is what they were used to. So another god just being around, you would just toss them in your own pantheon versus how, like I said, going forward with the European colonization, where that there wasn't that, there was no accepting of any other god but this god. And that's where the persecution comes in and the Inquisition, because the Spanish, though, in their own countries did eradicate any idea other than the Catholic Church, which had their own differences between Protestantism. So all of that is how Christianity would have made its way over to Japan. And how people, yeah, in smaller villages would have taken to this idea of the suffering will be given grace as long as they're good. And it follows a lot of the Japanese culture as well, which is a lot of obedience and submission. So yeah, they would have utilized the religion to their own advantages to keep the masses in a humbling position. It's fascinating how religion is basically a power tool and has always been in these wars, whether it's Hinduism, Muslim, I don't even single out just Christianity. That became the dominant religion, but all of them beforehand were fighting wars in the name of religion, but the religion in itself was the seat of power and control over a much larger but poorer populace. I will say with the language, you make points, but I think there's a catch 22. I like your points about it because authenticity, and you know I'm saying that word wrong, is relevant, especially, yeah, don't have a whole series in Japan and everyone speaking English. What the fuck? However, there is the, I think that when you are making a story, because I actually had the same thought, because this is a story I want to write, and it's in India. So I'm not familiar with the language, but I want to write the story based on things that I want. And if it was ever to be a movie, they're speaking a language that no one really speaks anymore, right? So if I want to, is it more important that the crowd that I'm trying to get this story and culture and traditions about learn this by making it more accessible for them to understand? Or do I stick to the authenticness of the culture, including down to the actual language? Because language has changed. Even the language they spoke then is not the same language they speak now. So I actually, I think, respectively disagree only in the principle that it's more important to me that people learn about Japanese culture than whether or not the actors are speaking actually Japanese. I think dubbing is terrible. If it's English and Japanese and you're listening to it all the way in English dubbing, now that I find, yeah, that's a crime against my ears. But I know that the people that do that will say the exact same thing that you were referencing. Like, I can't catch up and it's taking me out of the experience of watching because I can't follow along. And see, dubbing does that to me, but like I said, you have to come back to that question. Then if you even go back, like let's be real. If they even had a movie in old times and they were speaking English and it was old English, not only would the person in English that was talking to the old English not understand what was saying, we as the audience wouldn't understand a fucking word that is being said. So I think that it is, I think your point of adding more original dialogue when the setting is in a different country, I'm 100% with you. You can integrate, especially when you have a lot of the actors who probably can speak the dialect. But I do think that having someone that's there in English and being our introduction into that world and being speaking the same language we understand is actually a smart move from Disney to get people interested in the culture and all of the things that are going on. And I think that's way, way more important than being true to form. And I think Rodriguez is Spanish. He's been speaking Spanish. He doesn't speak a lot of Portuguese, but he does speak Spanish. And it's funny because back in the day, and this is a little bit of the derogatoriness towards Europeans and the Spanish and the, because keep in mind, the Europeans were, Spanish and the French were against the, well, the French up until they were mortal enemies. They went back and forth, but at this time, I'm pretty sure, yeah, because they were both with the Catholic Church. They were against, or no, Spain was with the Catholic Church, so they were frenemies with Spain and Portugal. But Britain itself and the Dutch, which are basically an offset of Britain's, they just did, all the hippies decided to move to a different place and call it Deutschland. But truly, it's just rich European whites that got out of Dodge when shit was getting cray cray. And during that time, we're talking about the English Wars, the Civil Wars. And the Dutch was all about trade power. And yeah, they were Protestant too. They separated themselves away from, I keep forgetting where Elizabeth and King Henry is. I think it's around King Henry, because that's when they changed the Protestant. But then they made treaties with, when they turned Protestant, with the Britons. And now I completely forgot my whole point that I was making because it just went out of my brain. Oh, about the Spanish. Oh, okay. So yes, most Britons were only taught Latin and French. So they wouldn't know how to speak Spanish or Portuguese. So despite the superpower of the time being Spanish and Portuguese, that's how much the Britons were like, we don't associate with them. Because in their minds, they're savages. I think that your assessment of Taranag, our homeboy, I'm going to respectfully disagree on that one as well. Just based on the three heart part at the end, I think motherfucker is sly as fuck. I think that he is playing the part that he needs to remain humble, to get, like, people, when you want power and you're power hungry, you, like he was saying, you don't scheme out in the open. And you don't convince other people that you're scheming. No, the best way to get people to you and make them believe, oh, he had to do it. It's because they were totally going against him. He's, if anything, he's pretty damn smart. And I think that introductory scene to me speaks more volumes about the type of person I'm dealing with than all of the, what do you want to call it, politicking he was doing to everyone around that was necessary. But yeah, you would never come out and be like, yeah, of course they think I'm power hungry. Yeah, let me come out and tell them I'm power hungry. No, the Ishido wants power. And then he knows that his competition is doing it in a diplomatic way and not in a war way. And now that's got him on his radar and he wants to take out his enemy. So now he needs to find a way to, and he has Fate drop something on his lap that he can now utilize in his own situation. He does have a son. That's the one who handed him the hawk. But I think, like, when he said that, I was like, yeah, no. Maybe just because I've just known the political game when it comes to these people at top, that I may feel I know them and how it's played a little bit. I wasn't buying it at all. I was like, no, you know exactly what you're doing. And you're not showing anyone your hand. Because whatever his secret goal is, which is to be Shogun, that's only with him and himself. He's a man of ambition. He's a man who's been used as a pawn. He wants control over his life and he's tired of the shit that's going on around him. And someone has to be the one to step up and unite people. And you can't do it being a bloodthirsty, openly ambitious person like Ishido seems to be. And I think that's going to be his downfall, despite the fact that he's able to sway the council. Because he probably said, hey, this guy's coming for you. You got to come after him first. And lastly, she was a courtesan. I do want to see Kiku again, too, because I was like, I like you. Like you said, any person that can come in and know their job so well that no words need to even be spoken, that's a person well worth their money. And then lastly, we humans have come up with insane ways to kill each other. And you just think about the worst torments in history that the church have come up with, and kings and just regular people. Or you think about how normalized it was for people to spend a day at the execution block watching people dance the hangman's jig and being pissed when they didn't get that. Like, if someone died quickly, the masses would, I mean, yeah, this has always been a part of our nature. And I think that when you reconcile just how bloodthirsty our species is and how much we kept that normalized for longer than we've been trying to be civil and human, or humanizing things that are just fucked up, which is not very long. Which always appalls me every time I remember it. Yeah, I was not shocked. I was more like, oh man, they're starting to see some of these punishments we used to That's what we did to Christians. That's what Christians did to savages. That's what Christians did to other Christians. This is fucking crazy, the things we did each other. Okay, just insane. Some of the punishments we decided to come up with. I thought it was going to be... I thought it was going to be a, what's the word I'm looking for? Crucifixion. When you say he had his special way. I thought it was going to be crucifixion. So I was, the boiling water, definitely. It's like, oh shit. Yeah. And everyone has to hear the screams. You can hear the fear, the power, like I said, but the normalcy of it all. And I know you hated his character and I'm sure there's plenty there worth hating. But I find him fascinating. Not likable, but fascinating. And, oh yeah, lastly, sorry, seppuku, that is basically in Japan, when you have crossed the line or you have dishonored yourself, you have like two options, live in dishonor, and then be forced to die an even more painful death, or die with honor and commit seppuku, which is basically, you saw it before because you watched Westworld, like you said, where you cut your belly. Remember when he was there and they were in the samurai world, and then after the fight he lost, he stabbed himself and then he cut off his head. That's assisted seppuku. When you have a friend do it for you. Seppuku was all the way up until World War II. This is how Japan people, and some people are still bringing it back as their tradition of how they handle dishonor in their society. Dishonoring is basically the worst thing you could possibly do. And it gives them control, like they were saying, over their death. if you refuse seppuku, I'm pretty sure, like, you have to accept any of the consequences that are brought upon you. But like I said, they're going to torture you. And you're going to die without honor. And once seppuku is, once you're given permission to commit seppuku, if he didn't give him permission, he would have been dishonored. He would have still died, but now his whole entire family would have lived in shame and lost everything that was of worth. Versus if he dies with honor, he would have redeemed himself in the eyes of society. And I like that the fact that they actually showed, because when you see it in other forms, they don't actually show that it is a process, that they actually put on the white robes, that they are in a room, that it can be assisted. People who couldn't stab themselves, they used to use fans. And then once you grab the fan, the person that was assisting the seppuku would just chop off your head. Yeah, so this is just a part of, this is why you had the Japanese Yakuza, or not the Yakuza, the suicide bombers. This is an honorable way that they consider death. And yes, your family line does go with it. Everyone in your family would die. That's why everyone keeps saying, Taranaga, if you are sentenced to death, your whole entire fiefdom is basically, like, everyone honor, like, high up in your house all commit seppuku, and then everyone else is just massacred. So, tradition. To give you a little bit more insight on to what was happening there. And yes, now we're finally going to wrap up the podcast. Once again, if you want to send feedback, blackercouch@gmail.com. If you leave a comment below, my social media will be there as well. Like, share, subscribe. Until the next time, peace, hair grease, and blacker magic.